Hello and welcome to Anarchy SF, the podcast companion to the Anarchy SF website. My name is Yanai, and with me, as always, is
Eden. Hello.
Yeah. I only now think that it's kind of weird that you have to say your name.
I don't.
Maybe I shouldn't.
I don't have to. We're free to express ourselves as we wish.
Well, are we free? Or are we, like, trapped within a hidden system that forces us to...
You know what's funny? It's like, are you a brain in a tank or like a butterfly having a dream or whatever? It's one of those, you know, questions you ask yourself the first time you get high when you're like 16 or something. And you think it's like the deepest shit. But I think 99% of all those questions have like simple solutions that you just need to read philosophy to answer, right? But this one doesn't. Like, it doesn't have a good answer, I would say.
Well, you know, philosophers, they're also still arguing about what exactly are colors and do we see the same colors.
But... Yeah, but I feel like there's at least like some good answers, right? And like good, you know, ways to think about it and kind of formulate it. Whereas the what if I am a brain in a tank question, I think is maybe sounds so basic that there aren't any good accessible resources, I feel, if you catch my drift, to kind of like start to ask that question in a more serious way.
I've noticed a trend with my rationalist friends, but not rationalist in like the bad internet way, that they all feel very comfortable with a total acceptance of determinism, that I'm like, you know, you think that this is the philosophically like very coherent position, but actually the thing is that there aren't coherent positions about determinism.
Yeah.
Like, none of the possible positions tracks, and there's actually something in this problem that we don't have a good solution for. And you can't just say, oh, it's all neurons firing. It doesn't even solve the problem even a little bit, so...
Yeah, I feel like, you know, it touches on Wittgenstein's framework beliefs, right? Like...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, axioms that are so basic to your perception that you don't have the tools to ask questions on them because you're... quote unquote trapped inside the system that they create.
Yeah, exactly, like the assumption that the external world exists, which is such an assumption. Like,
for sure.
It's not something that we can prove by appealing to the external world. So, if you haven't guessed, we're talking about The Matrix today, or you probably know it from the episode title.
Yeah.
The Matrix. I went on a journey with The Matrix because when it came out, it kind of blew my mind. And
it's still very good.
Yes, but it followed a decade of like galaxy brain takes and, you know, whoa, what if we're in the Matrix kind of conversations that kind of over time made me falsely remember this movie is kind of shallow.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a faux pas. People don't talk about the Matrix in philosophy. I think it's considered kind of like a lower culture kind of thing.
They do, but they only do it in like quote unquote populist circles, like serious philosophers don't talk about the Matrix.
Yeah.
And I think it's a classic example of, okay, this is a tangent, but it's going to be short. One of my history professors, you know, he heard us over talking and scoffing at some other like popular historian like Yuval Noah Harari or Jared Diamond or whoever. And he told us, you know, that's a skill. Writing something so academic in an accessible way is a skill. And the reason that so many academic historians, you know, lift their nose at these people and condescend is because they don't have that skill. They don't know, even if they wanted to, so they claim they don't want to, but even if they did, they wouldn't have the skill to actually do it. And I think The Matrix is a good example for philosophy. Like, I have a BA in philosophy, you have an MA in philosophy. Other really smart people that I know, if you sat them down with someone and you gave them 2 hours to explain the ideas like the Desert of the Real or Descartes, you know, radical skepticism, in 2 hours and make an impact like The Matrix, we can't do it, right? Like, it's a skill that we don't have.
I like how in your anecdote you accidentally said, instead of overheard us talking, heard us over talking, which is very appropriate.
Well, language is a broken tool, right? So as long as you understood what I was saying, it's fine.
No, I think that heard us over talking is actually appropriate.
Over talking is great. So let's get it out of the way. Everybody knows The Matrix, but let's just do the cut and dry stuff. The movie was released in 1999, which I think is fascinating and very funny that it released like a year before the millennium, and I think there's a lot to say about that, which I will say later.
2 years before 9/11.
2 years before 9/11, 1 year before the end of the millennium, a bunch of other stuff. At the end of the 90s, which was a big cyberpunk decade, and this is a very cyberpunk film. And it, of course, famously stars Keanu Reeves, arguably in his breakout role, although you can make the case for other movies. And other illustrious actors like Lawrence Fishburne and Carrie Ann Moss and Hugo Weaving and more. And of course, in the movie, Keanu Reeves plays Neo, or rather Thomas Anderson, who discovers that the world is a simulation created so that humanity can be batteries for the robots that have defeated us during a previous world war, the war to end all wars. And now we're all trapped in this simulation. And he is the one, the Messiah returned, aka Jesus Christ. And he can, you know, manipulate the code and free all of humanity from the clutches of these machines. It was written and directed by the Wachowski siblings, Wachowski sisters, who are both trans women, which is also interesting. And the film, there's a lot of discourse around it in trans and queer communities. The term red pill wasn't created by the Wachowski sisters. It was already something that was talked about in the trans community.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't know that. Again, it's the, you know,
but the estrogen pills are red, that's a thing.
Yeah, that's the source of the color, if I recall correctly, but it describes, you know, the realization that you're trans.
Sure.
And embracing that, and the movie popularized that term, and today it is, of course, used primarily by conservative people online to describe, you know, waking up to the reality of the fact that Trump is a white hat trying to save the world from a cabal of children-eating demons/reptilians, aka the Jews. It's been sort of like appropriated, but it's still used as a term to, you know, a rude awakening or realizing that you've been living in an illusion. Other famous things that The Matrix did is it popularized the idea of bullet time.
Yeah.
So taking a shot of a bullet and then slowing it down and showing the character dodging it. Again, the technology existed before The Matrix, but The Matrix popularized it. It involves like several cameras and then that classic spin that the cameras do that shows you all angles of the bullet time. And we could go on, like the whole idea of trench coats is something edgy, was existed beforehand in cyberpunk, but was made popular by The Matrix. You know, the phrase, I think no one in our society doesn't know the phrase, dodge this, right? Like one of the most iconic scenes from the movie. So arguably it's like one of the biggest movies ever and is iconic and has contributed to our culture in one way or another.
When I rewatched it, I was surprised that something else didn't take on. Something that is very unique to this film series is that the fight scenes in it are all theater fights. So in theater fights, they look more like kind of like dancing. A lot of the time you'll have someone fighting you, like lend you a hand so you can do a flip-flop or something. And if you watch the fights in The Matrix, they don't seem like very tactile. Like, when you see a punch, someone doesn't really look like they're being punched in this kind of, like, visceral way. It's more like coordination, like we're in a kind of weird dance battle.
I think
it's a very unique style to this movie.
Yeah, I think that actually did survive in the industry, and you see it most in Marvel movies, which take a very similar approach. If you think about the first team ensemble fight in Avengers, the first Avengers, the many mooks, or like rando pawns, are there for the characters to use them to maneuver around the geography and to show off their abilities and kind of build up their power level until they take on the big bad, which is very much the case in Matrix as well, right? Like you have to defeat all these little guys before you are fast enough to fight Agent Smith or another agent or whatever, right? So I think a lot of the Matrix's aesthetics were, I wouldn't say resurrected because I don't think they ever died. They did see other usages. For example, interestingly, in a lot of Zack Snyder's earlier work, like Sucker Punch, was a very Matrix-influenced film. So I think they were always extant and existing, but I think Marvel really took it to the next level and kind of resurrected it and made it more popular again. I will say two more things, like to get out of the way as far as The Matrix is concerned. One is, I spoke about 1999 and cyberpunk, so just to close off that loop, it's not just cyberpunk that saw its, which fancy word do I want to use here, sublimation, if I'll go Hegelian, sublimation in The Matrix, but also a very distinct genre of weird popular philosophy. So you can see it in Follow the White Rabbit, right, which opens the movie, the Alice in Wonderland reference. For years, like the mid-80s to the mid-2000s, I would say, every single person who wrote a popular book about consciousness, computing, simulation, used Alice in Wonderland. Right? Like, Alice in Wonderland appears in Gödel-Escher Bach by Hofstadter, which is like a huge book. If you think about stuff like House of Leaves and others of its genre, or other comic books that kind of influenced the Matrix. And it's not just Alice in Wonderland. It's this whole thread between consciousness and computing and reality was very hot. And the Matrix was kind of like the culmination of that, which I think people tend to forget. And then the last thing, to get all this prep work out of the way, yes, there were sequels. I think the second movie is not as bad as people remember it. It's not as good as the original, but it's not as bad, and it actually has some interesting things to flesh out. The third movie is terrible in my eyes, and it's very regrettable that they're now making a fourth one.
That is very regrettable. Only one of them is making it, by the way.
Oh, right, yeah. But I think Lily, I think her name is, that's not working on it, she cited exhaustion, so it's not like artistic differences or whatever. Like, they've been working nonstop, basically ever since The Matrix came out, if you think about how much time.
So I think there's a whole discussion that we won't get into of like how capitalism influences art and what that means for an art critic.
Yeah.
But I think that this movie only exists to turn a profit, and citing exhaustion is just like he doesn't want to screw his sister off.
Yeah, could be. We don't know her actual thoughts. So, but by the way, that opens up an interesting point. You know, the Wachowski sisters are incredibly hardworking if you think about how long it takes to make a movie. So since The Matrix, they've made Cloud Atlas and Sense8 and what's
Speed Racer,
right, and Jupiter Ascending, sadly, which was terrible movie. They're just constantly working. So, and then the last bit of trivia that we need to get out of the way, the Animatrix, which is an animated series of shorts, I think they're 10 minutes each and there's 5 of them, is better than all of the movies, including the original one.
I heard that. I still need to watch them.
You have to watch them. They're incredible. They do all of the fleshing out of the world, including like how humans and robots came to fight, and then how the first stages of the war looked like, and why humans decided to scorch the sky, and so on. And they're incredible, even better than the original in my eyes. And a lot of people haven't seen them, and it's a shame, and I think they're all available online. So, I mean, legally, of course, illegally, they are also available. But, you know, be gay, do crime. I don't care. So go and watch those. And now we can get into the thick of things.
Yeah, we could say, like, this is where spoiler territory begins. But, like, if you don't know what happens in the movie, I just don't know, like, what's going on with your life. Like, even if you haven't watched it, you should know everything.
This is the point where French philosophy begins. So if you want to just tune that out, you can just stop listening now.
I want to start actually before French philosophy with a kind of like basic question that I think is really nice about The Matrix, and did it survive as well? So there's a question that Morpheus asks Neo, which is, what is The Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
And he asks Neo that, and if you take it at face value, it's a dumb question. Neo doesn't and can't know what the Matrix is, right? He exists within the simulation. He has no way of knowing that it's a simulation. And there's no implication that Neo has any evidence that it's a simulation. So the question doesn't make sense at face value. Metaphorically, though, the reason that Orpheus asks him that is that there's the assumption that Neo feels a kind of alienation, a kind of something is wrong that he can't put his finger on. And what is the Matrix is a question that is supposed to egg him on to basically find the source of this weird feeling. And I feel like there are sentences like what is the Matrix that are very strong. I always cite Fury Road's Who Killed the World, which is also like a very good question to ask. So what is the Matrix is like a foundational question. I think it's more important than the term red pill, but it hasn't survived because I think it's more revolutionary in a way, because it's not appealing to a kind of revelatory answer. And I will at least talk about like what this revelation actually means, but it's saying you know, when something is wrong, instead of looking for the immediate source of problems in your life, you know, you can't get medicine because you don't earn enough, and like problems, well, your boss isn't paying you enough, or you know, you suck at your work or something, like those seem to be like kind of immediate problems. There's a question of like, turn your gaze towards the bigger picture, the system that you live within. You know, we talk a lot lately about systemic critique, right? Like, what are the systems that are making things as they are? And I think in a lot of cases, it's good to ask this question. What is the matrix in this situation?
So I'll tell you why I think that question didn't survive. I think that question didn't survive because there are actually two Matrix movies. The first one, not the sequels. One of which was made, and one of which is a potential Matrix movie that was never made and was made in the alternate version of our reality where, I don't know, Ronald Reagan ever got elected, or neoliberalism didn't, you know, have the world in its chokehold as powerfully as it did. And I think that first movie that got made and the second movie that didn't, they coexist up until we learn that Neo is actually the one. So I'll explain. And this kind of ties into one of my, I think you've actually heard me say this at talks that I give, that the Matrix as it stands, as it was made, is reactionary. It's a reactionary film, whether the Wachowskis intended it to be or not. Because the message is, you all fucking suck. You will never escape the Matrix. And if you try to do it, you will die. But somewhere amongst you is the one, and he is the only one that can stand up to the agents and free us from our slavery. And if you're not the one, and obviously you're not the one, because come on, what, you think you're the chosen one? Obviously not. Then it's pointless, right? As everybody tells Neo before he's the one in the movie, if you see an agent, you should run, right? So yeah. For 99.9% of us, everybody except for the Messiah, there's no point in fighting because the system will defeat you. They're faster, better, stronger than you, smarter, and you will be destroyed. And that's why the movie that got made is reactionary, because the answer and the sequel and the third one actually support that premise, is that all we can do is wait for the one, and then when he comes along, we should stand alongside them and fight, right? But there's a second movie where the question, what is the Matrix, is much more important, because in that version, Neo is not the one, and Morpheus is wrong, right? Which is a doubt that is cast throughout the first movie, up until we find out that Neo dies and Trinity tells him that she loves him, and then he wakes up and he's Christ, right? There's a version where he fucking dies. And the question, what is the Matrix? The answer is, it's all of us. Right? Like everyone, if you think about it, humans are the power source that's powering the Matrix. Because they're the power source that powers all of the machines, because the sun is gone. So if every single person in the Matrix were to wake up somehow, then the Matrix would die in that instant. Right? If you could disconnect all of the humans, all of the machines would die in that very same instant, because power would be gone. In that second version, like Morpheus is wrong, and then the sequel is, okay, there is no chosen one, what do we do now? And I don't know, maybe you follow along with the people in Zion as they try to like hack the mainframe for the machines. I know how I would end it. I would end up with them failing, but that's because I'm a depressive motherfucker and I like bad endings, but it doesn't have to end that way. Maybe it ends with, you know, humans taking control or shutting down the Matrix, or I don't know, like a cyborg machine clone. That's where I saw the movies going, by the way, when I thought about the sequels before they existed. But the reason that movie doesn't exist is because it's actually revolutionary. Right? Because what it says is, you don't need a Lenin, you don't need a Marx, you don't need a Jesus Christ. The people who make the revolution, and I'm quoting here from the Jesus Christ of communism, right? Karl Marx, the people are the ones who make history. Right? They are the prime motivator. And the Matrix, as it was made, tells us the exact opposite, which is why the question, what is the Matrix, got sidelined. Because, yeah, the Matrix is the cloth on which Neo writes his story. That's how what it becomes in the actual movie.
So I'll get to it, but I like what you said about two movies, and I think some of the second movie you talk about is trying to survive within the existent movies, including the... So there are cinematic moments and plot points that are in tension with this idea of the one, including, I think, the ending. But I want that to be my final point, so we'll get there.
Cool. So maybe feeding off this discussion of the Messiah, I can kind of go one step deeper and say that I think in that regard, there might be something still left to salvage as revolutionary in the film that actually got made, because it tries to hold up a mirror to how people see their liberation, right? So maybe, I think Trinity is a really good example. I don't know if the Wachowskis meant for it to be that way, but I hate Trinity as a character. She is so capable, she's so badass, and yet for the first movie as well, but even worse in the sequels, she's just waiting on Neo's word, right? Like, she becomes completely subservient to him. Sure, they disagree about stuff, but at the end of the day, he's the leader and she's just waiting for him to appear. Of course, she has like the traditional, you know, role of the woman whose love saves the man, whatever. Maybe we can, you know, give the Wachowskis a break and say that they do subvert it in interesting ways, which we can talk about later. But I think it does... In that sense, as a mirror, you know, it calls all of us trinities, right? It says, look at you. This is what you're doing. Like, you're waiting for the Messiah. And I think it's a real problem within communism, right? This is my second point, but I can start it now. Communism is a movement, has something millenarianist about it. Right? And millenarianism is any movement that thinks about the end of the world and the world to come, right? So classically Christianity, right? And it's called millenarianism because you're waiting for the millennium. Not the millennium as in a date, but the millennium is in the rule of Jesus Christ, right? Like the 1,000 years of peace before we all ascend to heaven. That's what's supposed to happen when Jesus Christ returns, right? He'll spend 1,000 years on earth and then we'll all ascend to heaven along with him. So if you think about it, because communism or some communists believe in this idea that, you know, communism will abolish everything. It will abolish the world as we know it. I mean, some communists, I believe in that as well, right? I just don't think it will be instantaneous. Mm-hmm. It will abolish gender and power relations and the state and other stuff. There is a millenarianist tone to it because, you know, the old world is dead and the new world arrives. The problem is that when you think that catalyst will be the right person, right? Like, what we need is another Lenin, or what we need is another Castro or Che Guevara, or you choose one of the many personalities upon which leftists have made altars in the last 100 years.
I would say, not even thinking that it's one person, because I think that's like actually ridiculous, even thinking that, you know, it will be one kind of movement, political idea, party, organization that will, you know, land on the right course of action, and then we'll all kind of recognize it, join it, and it'll sweep the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, in movie language, that's a person, because it's hard to make that like an organization.
Yeah.
But I think what you're talking about is like slightly larger than it being one person. It's
yeah,
like
for
waiting
sure.
for a sign, you could say.
Yeah, the elect, just like the Protestants, right? Waiting for the elect to lead the way. And that's fucked up. Like, you know, it's not their fault, right? Like, we're not in the business of blaming anyone because, as you alluded to, it's all systemic criticisms, right? But it's interesting the extent to which we are unable to free ourselves from the matrix, right? Our matrix, that it's hard for us to detach ourselves from the idea of individualism and the role of the individual. Here, again, not intended as a singular person, but as you said, like a group of people or an act or a political party. That's how we were taught that the world works, right? That politics work, that history works. And even if we're Marxists and we, you know, do our reading and we do our thinking, it still creeps up on us, right? It still like finds its way into our way of thinking.
And yeah,
I think it's mostly, and this is the last thing I'll say, you know, of course, this touches, you know, when you talk about the Matrix today, the mode is, of course, to talk about capitalist realism and all that stuff. But we've talked about it so much on the cast that I don't think there's a point. Like, I think the listeners can fill in the blanks themselves. But what's interesting here in the manifestation of capitalist realism is because all you're waiting for is that group. And after them, nothing will be the same. Just like after Jesus Christ, nothing will be the same. Sorry for all the Christian metaphors, by the way. I'm reading. I just finished Book of the New Sun. So like Christian metaphors is all I'm doing these days. There's no point in imagining the world after, because you can't. It's a framework belief, right? After Christ comes, after communism comes, everything will change. And the world as we as it will be then is completely unknowable to us now. But that's a failure, right? That's a failure of our imagination to imagine the world after communism, because we're waiting for the Messiah to change everything and bring it about.
So to connect to that, I said that I think the movie is in tension with itself. Like maybe the two movies you talk about are within the movie. Or, you know, the three movies as one movie, because I like some things about the third movie, and the thing I like the most is the fight for Zion. I think it's a really beautiful portrayal of a big fight, and I was comparing it to like Helm's Deep or something, which just isn't as good. And what I really like about it is, first of all, I think you're right that the story is so much more interesting if the one, like the doubts about the one turn out to be true and Neo isn't the one, or there isn't a one. And they kind of allude to it, like he becomes the one because he thinks he's the one, but that's a cop-out. But in the fight for Zion, the characters that participate in that fight operate from the belief that Neo has failed, even Morpheus, because things don't happen as they were supposed to, and it seems like Zion is just going to be destroyed. And what I really like about that fight scene, and like, yeah, the part with the walkers is a bit ridiculous, but what I really like about the scene is the way that it portrays society, I don't know, like a community, fighting where every individual has like a role in the fight, but it's not like this coordinated plan, this Ocean 11 thing, where like, you know, if everyone does something right, like we'll get it. It's everyone knows what their job is, and they're going to do it, and they're just going to assume that everyone else is also doing their job. And if, you know, part of this collapses, we're all going to die. But all I can do is just look at the thing I'm supposed to do and just do it, because I can't do the big picture. So you have, like, these cuts between... So there's the front line with the walkers shooting at the robots, sure. But then they show the people who are supposed to deliver the ammunition to the walkers. And, you know, it's a whole group of people who are just, like, running with carts. But you also need them, because otherwise the walkers can't keep shooting. And then you have people who guard the people who run with the carts. And I think that's really clever. Like, yeah, you can't just have the people running with carts. Someone has to guard them. So you have people with these, like, electric rifle weird stuff. And those people, you know, think about how they see the fight. Like, their job is just to follow people with carts of ammunition to make sure that they don't die before they recharge the robots. The walkers that are supposed to shoot the robots, like, they're so supposedly insignificant. And all these side characters get, like, you know, kind of their moment. So there are two women who, like, together operate this, like, rocket launcher kind of thing. They're supposed to take down big targets. And one of them says to the other, like, I'm super terrified, but you keep charging, I'll keep shooting. Because, you know, they can't see the big picture. They can't know that they're going to be okay. But they just have to keep doing their job.
Go ahead.
So I think that is a very good portrayal of what it's like to be part of an actual movement where you can't like have the whole picture in mind. You can't know that you're doing the revolution. You can't know who is doing the revolution, but you have to like.
Yeah, and I think just to drive that point home, like it's obviously an answer to the Matrix. Like it's the opposite than the Matrix. In the Matrix, in the first movie, again and again, the point that they harp upon is you're a cog, you're insignificant, you're this tiny piece of the machine, and that is supposed to crush you and make you complacent, right? Because if you're this tiny thing, then what use is revolt, right? But then Zion is like the mirror image of that, saying, yeah, but this is how human society is supposed to work. Like you're supposed to be a cog, you're supposed to be a tiny part, but it's not a bad thing. Out of those tiny parts, we make whatever human society makes, right? whether it's good stuff or bad stuff. So it's kind of a mirror image of, you know, one of the things I like the most about the first Matrix is that it's not really clear the city that they're in when they're in the Matrix. Like, people say it's in New York, but they just say that because of out of force of habit, right? And nowhere is like a landmark that is New York is shown, and all of the addresses are super generic. They give like three addresses for phone lines, and they're all really generic. And that's on purpose, right? Because the idea is the monotony and the anonymity of the city. That's the whole point behind the woman in red exercise. Right? Like, you're swimming in this sea of black, and suddenly there's the woman in red. But that's how they get you, right? The uniqueness becomes the trap. And I think...
Yeah, and this is a good time to mention that the Matrix, like, the scenes in the Matrix are extremely white, like a lot of white people there. Whereas, especially in the sequels, Zion is a lot of people of color. Specifically a lot of black people. The music that they listen to is not Western music. It's this, like, weird... It's not weird. It's like, drum
Yeah, I mean,
stuff.
It's influenced by... It's usually called, which is also orientalistic, world music, but it's influenced like by African tribal music and beats and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I just think like it's something that's not talked about a lot, but like for a blockbuster movie, like so many, you know, named
I mean, even if you look at the first movie, like you have Morpheus, Tank, and Dozer. Dozer dies, but Tank lives. Right.
Yeah, and he's important throughout the sequels.
Yeah, for sure. And whereas Cypher and Switch, who are both white and side characters, they die. Spoilers. I totally agree with you. And I think, of course, that's not by accident. But I think that also touches on my second point. Well, I think one of the clever things that the movie does, and yeah, the sequels as well, like the first one didn't really have it, and the sequels show that society a bit more because Zion is portrayed very quickly in the first movie, is that when you tear away the Matrix, people have to relearn everything. Right? Like, they don't know how to talk. They don't know how to tell stories. They don't know how to eat. They don't know how to be with other people or to organize, because the Matrix was a totality. Now, in loaning that, metaphorically, going back to what I said about communism and abolishing everything, and yes, it's bad to wait for that messiah and not imagine that world. But to be clear, like I think the left has forgotten in many ways and doesn't talk about it. Communism will abolish everything. Everything. Everything that we know is predicated on capital.
Your mom abolished.
Yeah. Well, you said that as a joke, but parental child relationships will be abolished. They will be different under communism. I'm not saying they won't exist, but they will look nothing like the relationships that we know. And I think that's a really big deal. Like, one of the failures of the kibbutz movement in Israel, which was not only socialist, but communist, is that they just thought they could pretend that people could just give up their children. And when you talk to, like, second-generation kids from the kibbutz today, they say that one of the main reasons that they left is that they didn't want to grow their children, to raise their children that way.
Yeah, my mom, by the way, is a hardline objector to that line. She thought that it was fine. She grew up like that. Sure. She was that child who grew up in like with all the other children away from their parents, and she thought that it was fine. I mean, obviously, she has a relationship with her parents, and they would meet their parents. They would spend weekends with them, but
But I think that's a really good example of how communism abolishes everything, and it's not just that; it's the school system and food, like the relationship that we have with food and how we eat and what we eat and where we get it from, and travel and sex and gender and all of those things, right? They will all be abolished, just like the Matrix. So I think what the movie is trying to tell you, and this goes also back to the transness of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. That in your new life, the things that you thought were obvious, they were only obvious because you were cis. Right, like you conformed. It was easy for the system to catalog you. Therefore, and we've spoken about this on the cast before, there was no friction. But now that you did the right thing, you did the right thing. You took the red pill, that's the right thing. Like you escaped the Matrix. But now there's going to be a lot of work to reinstate systems in the place of the systems that you just abolished. And you abolished everything. So good luck. Like, welcome. And now you have to rebuild the world, basically. Which I think is a very astute point that a lot of people on the left, like, there's this idea, you know, the whole idea behind luxury communism. It's not going to be easy, guys. It's not going to be easy. You know, like, there's this meme about, you know, the day after the CEO leaves and all the workers find out that they can just run the factory. No, that's not how it's going to work. Like, when we kick out all the CEOs, like, there's a reason Russia basically collapsed after the 1917 revolution. When you kick out the old order, there's an interim of great suffering and labor and work, hard, back-breaking work to be done, sometimes in an office, sometimes literally in a factory floor, sometimes in a farm or in the military, to protect the revolution and to build the new state, because we just abolished fucking everything and someone has to put it back in place. So I think Zion is a really good example of how that works and how hard it is and what's needed in order to do it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also that Zion is kind of like a heartfelt view of, like, yes, our lives are very hard and we have these duties, but we are all committed to this project and we know it's going to be hard. We know it's hard to get out of the Matrix and it's a hard life to choose, but we're not making the choice that, I don't remember, Taser?
What's Cypher.
Cypher, sorry. We're not going to try to take a pill that will just, like, put us to sleep and go back to, like, capitalist relations. We're going to try to...
I gotta do an aside here about naming conventions in these films. It's really funny how heavy-handed they are. Like, calling the city Zion is so heavy-handed. And, yeah, but also calling him Cypher, which is like a hidden message, right?
Yeah.
And he's the traitor. It's so, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's so funny, like, how subtle these movies can be and then how heavy-handed and, like, on the nose they can sometimes be. It's ridiculous.
I want to set up what I think is your last point by talking about philosophers being snooty about the Matrix. And I want to start with the snootiest.
The snootiest to do it.
That Matrix most seeked his approval. So, or sought his approval, as you would say if you could speak English. So, the Matrix simps for Baudrillard. It's...
I think
you need the word simp here because it is kind of like desperate how much the Matrix wants Baudrillard to love it.
Yeah.
Like, it drops all these references, you know, Desert of the Real, Baudrillard books. Like, you know the original scene with Desert of the Real? He was supposed to, like, read that paragraph from the book. Like, the movies really wanted to. Like, and Simulation Simulacra was required reading for the actors.
It's in the first scene of the movie. Right? Like, yeah, where Neo keeps the floppy disk or whatever.
Yeah, they really wanted Baudrillard to like it. They even tried to hire him as a consultant. And he refused and he hated the Matrix. And I'll link in the show notes to a really good video about that. So I'm here to tell you that he was wrong. And I'm going to explain why. So here's a quote of slightly edited of what Baudrillard had to say about the Matrix. The setup is crude and does not truly evoke the problem. The actors are in the Matrix, or they are radically outside it. But what would be interesting is to show what happens when these two worlds collide. The most embarrassing part of the film is that the new problem posed by simulation is confused with its classical Platonic treatment. So what Baudrillard is basically saying here is, if you read my books, the problem is that you confuse the simulation for the thing being simulated. Mm-hmm. And in your movie, there is no such confusion. Okay, hold that in mind, because I'm going to bring in another snooty philosopher, Slavoj Žižek, that I think understands the movie a little better, but still does it an injustice.
Boo.
So, there's a really good film from, like, old Žižek, before he was a boo-worthy, called A Pervert's Guide to Cinema.
Yeah.
Here, pervert does not mean sexual pervert, but, like, and he means for us to make that confusion, but it means, like, someone who's perverse, who's, like, the outsider, etc., etc. And he talks about a lot of films, but about this film, he shows the scene of the blue pill and the red pill, and here's what he has to say about it. The choice between, this is a quote, the choice between the blue and red pill is not really the choice between illusion and reality. These are fictions which already structure our reality. If you take away from our reality the symbolic fictions that regulate it, you lose reality itself. I want a third pill. a pill that would enable me to perceive not the reality behind the illusion, but the reality in illusion itself. And please thank me for not doing the Slavoj Žižek accent. So,
thank you.
What Žižek is saying is that he also kind of wants to resist the dichotomy, but he wants to resist it in a way that is actually contradictory with Baudrillard's resistance, because he thinks that it's not about confusing the virtual for the real. It's about the virtual, the fictions that we create, have a higher sort of truth in that they kind of sublimate our actual desires, our actual feelings.
Yeah.
A friend of mine like asked me, you know, this premise where the machines need the humans for energy, that's nonsense. That's not how energy works. Like, there's obviously something more complicated about why there is even a matrix. And Žižek is saying here, there is a matrix because we need to sublimate some emotions. We can't just say what we feel. It's not actually possible. So here's why I think that Baudrillard gets the matrix wrong and Žižek gets it mostly wrong. So the problem with Baudrillard is that he thinks, and it's the problem with both of them, that the red pill and blue pill scene are the last scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really not. It's not a movie about finding out that you're in the matrix and just getting out of it. Most of the movie is about, you know, the freedom fighters,
going back.
Going back into the matrix. That's what's so important. Yeah. The place where we need to struggle with the system is within the system. To be a leftist is not to donate all of your... It's not like Jesus. You don't donate all of your belongings and now you're just. Like, it's not about disconnecting from the... You can disconnect yourself from the system if you want. Like, I guess there must be people in Zion just, like, living their life. Whatever, that's not revolutionary. To be revolutionary, you have to go back to the place where the thing is happening and you have to struggle with it. And the power that Neo has, but also other people have, like, he teaches them, basically. They teach him and then he teaches them to surpass it. The power that they have is exactly to see the truth within illusion. It's to be within the matrix, but still understand what parts of it are actually true. Like, you can't just let yourself be hit by a lot of bullets,
yeah.
Because, like, in a some of this is actually true, but some of this is fake. You can stop the bullets in air. So, what I think is really interesting about the movie is the moment, and I think every leftist knows this moment where you're like, wait, all of the systems around me are kind of bullshitting me, like, 24/7. It's all nonsense. Like, this whole capitalist framework is just lying to me constantly to just, you know, a small veneer hiding power, right? But that realization is not the end of a struggle. It's barely the beginning of a struggle. The struggle is going back into these systems and finding ways to subvert them, which is the actual hard part because they are so good at maintaining themselves.
So I agree with you, but... And this is where I'll go back to my second point and talk about that future that communists sometimes fail to imagine and kind of sort of contradict myself, but you'll forgive me. And it starts from sort of agreeing with Baudrillard in the following way. As the movie posits it, Cypher is correct. Right? Within the framework of the movie and the way that the world exists as a burnt out husk with no hope of resuscitation, and the only thing waiting for you outside the Matrix is like an underground existence where you eke out your life and it's endless war and endless fighting. Cypher is correct and you should prefer the Matrix. Or I'll say it differently. Thinking that freedom and liberty is an inherent virtue in and of itself is liberal. It's not leftist. The actual freedom isn't worth anything if you don't do anything with it, right? Like, it's the same case with, you know, when people point at people who join modern militaries, right? What do you want? It was their choice, right? Like, they drafted of their own in America, for example, where there's not a mandatory draft. Mm-hmm. And also in Israel, because the mandatory draft here is bullshit and you can get away with it if you wanted to non-enlist, right? They chose to do it. The choice vindicates whatever came afterwards, because what's important is that they had the choice. That's a liberal ideal. No, the only reason to take the red pill, the only reason to become a leftist, or communist, more accurately, is exactly what's written in the fucking Communist Manifesto. You have nothing to lose but your chains, and you have a world to win. Like, if we take the red pill and we become communists and we abolish the current situation of things, then yes, like I said before, and this is where I sort of contradict myself, but not really, there will be hard years and a lot of work. But at the end, our beautiful reward is a communist society where everyone has a home and everyone can eat and everyone can be educated and everyone can express themselves and be who they want to be. On a gender spectrum and on a sexual spectrum and on a social spectrum, like, we are not fighting for the desert of the real, right? If the alternative, if the choice is between the Matrix and the desert of the real, give me the Matrix every single day, because there is no reason to go outside, because the liberty itself is meaningless to me. But if the choice is between, even if the choice is minuscule, like the chances that I'll actually get it, but there's a possibility that my struggle will lead to not the desert of the real, the meadow of the real, right? Yeah. The prosperous valley of the real. Then I want to take the red pill. Then I want to break free of the Matrix, because there's promise. Even if, like, the problem with Zion is that the war is lost. Like, the world is gone. Even if they defeat the machines, Earth is destroyed. And they will live an existence that is on the very border of survivability. Why would you want that? Right? So, and I think that's where the film kind of fails and kind of falls into, again, into liberal patterns. And maybe Baudrillard meant this and maybe he didn't, or maybe I'm making my own critique, right? But I can sort of understand this idea that says it doesn't really fully explain or show the actual problem with the simulation, right? The actual unreality of reality, right? The actual, like Zizek said, you know, to quote the famous blue ink, red ink speech, right?
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that we don't have the ink to manifest our problems. That's the problem. It's not this, like, everybody knows that we live in an illusion. Everybody, listen, everybody, even like the most capitalist, libertarian, whatever, they also know that it's bullshit. But they either buy into it willingly because, like Cypher, right, they want to get ahead. If we're all in an illusion, then I'll be a rich person inside of an illusion. Or they don't have the language, which, and this is more the case for most people, they don't have the language to articulate anything else. They can't conceive of an alternative. And again, we come back to capitalist realism, of course. Can't talk about the Matrix without actually talking about Mark Fisher, right? Like, there is no alternative. And that's the problem. And in a sense, Matrix is guilty of that. Because that's what it tells you. You have the illusion or you have suffering. You have the Matrix or you have endless war. And that, those are your options. Choose. I really think that if most people were given that choice, they would choose Cypher.
So you're saying you want a third pill?
No. I want the red pill, but I don't want the fucking desert. I don't want to live in the desert. I already do live in an actual desert and it fucking sucks.
I think the good thing about The Matrix is how it invokes these questions, and I don't know how we're supposed to read Zion, because you're right, like, it's a terrible war out there, but also there's the feeling that it's kind of like what you said in the beginning about struggle, right? Like, if they just find a kind of stalemate with the machines, Zion itself is not shown to, like, have, you know, food sourcing problems or poverty or anything.
Oh, like, yes, it does. Yes, there, it does. Yes, it does. Like, okay, there's no poverty, but, like, it's a diesel punk setting, right? Like, everything is dirty. You need to conserve resources at all times because you live on the brink. You eat the fucking slop, right? I won't eat the bugs. There's a leftist meme going around right now. Yeah. It's like that. I won't eat the bugs. I won't live in the pod. That's your reality. Like, there's no personal space. You can't choose what your profession is because the harsh centralized system for eternity, again, not for 10 years, but for eternity, assigns you, like, all the labor that needs to be done to maintain this, like, huge machine that you live inside of. You'll never see the sky. You'll never see plants. You'll never see animals. Like, it's a nightmare. It sucks.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read Zion as that. Like, everyone in Zion are, like, happy to come to Zion. They like Zion. They talk about Zion longingly.
Sure, but so here's a third Matrix movie that wasn't made, that it's a dream within a dream, right? And they don't realize it, but Zion is also part of the simulation. And yeah. There are parts in the third movie that actually hint when Neo uses his powers in the real world. One of the readings of that is they're actually in a simulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look, we don't have to agree on it, and it's not my perspective. I'm not saying Matrix bad, right? Like, we're trying to do some capital N nuance here. Just saying there are aspects of the Matrix that I can totally agree with Baudrillard on. I mean, don't get me wrong. He didn't like the movie because, again, it like put a finger in his eye, right? And it was able to explain his ideas way better than he was ever able to explain them to the masses.
So my issue with Baudrillard is not the thing that you touched on. My issue with Baudrillard is that Baudrillard was really invested in the idea that we will start confusing simulation with reality.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of wrong about that. I don't think
he was wrong.
Problem. So I'll say my piece. I don't think that the problem with, you know, virtual spaces nowadays is that you could ever mistakenly think that you are in a virtual space when you are in the real space or vice versa.
But the move you're making there is that you're assuming that reality sips into virtual spaces and makes them real. But that's exactly the opposite of what Baudrillard is saying. What Baudrillard is saying is that the virtual starts to leak out of the virtual spaces and starts to make the real fake. So I'll give you an example. Were whips used on Haitian refugees 2 days ago?
Sure, yeah. There's the thing with, like, they weren't actual whips. They were using the harnesses to whip
them. No, they weren't actually whipping anyone. Like, the person who took those images said, they're out of context. No whipping was done at all. Again, it was still terrible. They rode them down with fucking horses. And, like, the deportation and the immigration policies in the United States are a war crime and a crime against humanity. Don't get me wrong for a second. But that's exactly the point. Like, you try to put your finger on reality. A war crime is being done. A crime against humanity is being done by the United States. I want to know a fact about this. You can't. You can't know a fact.
Oh, yeah. So, and that's the thing. That, I think, is way more interesting than, and I just don't think that that's what Baudrillard is getting at with. He really wanted the actors not to know if they're in the Matrix or not.
No, I
don't think that's the problem. I mean, the problem is that you know that the way that information is transmitted today is troubled and always filtered and always not even like agenda. It's like it's mimified like 1,000 times before it gets to you, and there are narratives and counter narratives, and it's really, really hard to put your finger on a fact. And I feel that that's the problem of being in a digital world, that everything has been processed so much before you can even touch.
Yeah, but that's exactly what Baudrillard is saying. I mean, not about the quote about the Matrix. Again, I agree with you that his critique of the movie is wrong and like badly motivated. But I'm talking about Simulacra and Simulation, the essay. I like the ideas, regardless of the movie, that then what he thought of it. The point of the actual essay is exactly that the real and not the simulation becomes more simulated.
Yes.
It's, right? It's not that the simulation becomes realer. It's that the real becomes a simulation, right?
Yes. So, and like, and the I agree with that, and I love putting out for those. I think those are brilliant.
For sure. No, I'm not trying to like catch you out on anything, right? I'm just saying that I think it's interesting how he failed in his encounter with the movie. He failed to like critique it in a way that points towards, like, don't tell me why the Matrix is wrong. Tell me why your ideas are right. See what I'm saying? And then show me how far the Matrix falls from it. But I don't think he was able to do it. Okay, long enough. One last anecdote. I was Googling Simulacra and Simulation for a quote. And the second result, you know, the people ask part, where they show you like common questions. Are simulacrums real?
Oh, no. And whoever is listening to this, please try to think for a moment to yourself how to approach a question like, are simulacrums real?
Are simulacrums real is just an amazing question. By the way, maybe final note here. Simulacra and Simulation is fucking fantastic. It's like super fucking good. And I'm not going to pretend that it's an easy read, but it's not like, I don't know, Foucault at his worst or Kant or something, Hegel or something super technical. Like, it's hard to read and you should probably like read online while you read it for some guides or ideas and stuff like that. But you can also just pick it up. And it's free online, like PDFs of it are everywhere. And it is incredible. Like, it's one of those cliche texts that are actually cliche for a reason. It's mind-blowing. I read it every few years, and every time I find something new that's very rich. Please, please, please read it. It's very fucking good. That's it.
Cool. So, that's our thoughts about The Matrix.
Yeah.
Eden, anything you've watched, read, you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we'll end up doing an episode on this or not, but my brain has been colonized by a book called Gnomon, G-N-O-M-O-N, by Nick Harkaway, who is the son of John le Carré, the famous spy novel writer.
Mm-hmm.
He has written two full-length fiction books. The first one is Gone Away World, which is also very, very good. And this one is very related to The Matrix. It posits like this utopian UK where society is under complete surveillance by an algorithm that's so sophisticated that it can also infer like internal states. So it can't read your mind, but it can like read your body language and know what you're feeling. So privacy doesn't exist anymore, like radically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a murder case and a detective is picking up on it and trying to unravel this conspiracy and whatever. And it turns out it's actually a dystopia. But what he does really, really interesting, first of all, it's very weird and out there and avant-garde, but it's very good. But he explores the benefits of the society as well. Like, instead of just saying surveillance bad. So like, for example, just a small example, people on the spectrum no longer need to hide it because they can't, right? Like, the algorithm will know. So they're freed from prejudice and stigma. They wear pins of different colors on their shirts, which explain where on the spectrum they are, like, roughly, so that people know how to interact with them in advance. And there's no more social shame because everything is out there in public. So that's an example of, like, a good thing that the society does. And I think it's really interesting because he could have easily gone into, like, the 1984 surveillance bad, privacy good. But instead, like, the book has a discussion. Like, what do you get from sacrificing your privacy to such an extent? It's really interesting and weird and very long. It's, like, 700 pages. And it's, like, not an easy read. So that's why I say it's colonized my mind. Like, I've been obsessed with it. I'm
don't read this book. It's a colonizer and canceled.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's what's been occupying me. How about yourself?
So I played an expansion, like the last update of Frostpunk. They released another scenario. And what I really love about these little things that Frostpunk is releasing is that, and they also announced Frostpunk 2, by the way.
Yeah.
Is that, which is going to be Dieselpunk, kind of fun.
Yeah.
What I really like about Frostpunk is that it's kind of an infrastructure for critique of power. So they released an expansion, and in this expansion, you play as someone in charge of a trading post. And in the original game, you set up these trading posts, and they just send you resources. And that's it. Like, set it up, get resources. And now you're like playing as this person in charge of the resource post, and now you have the problems of the resource post, and the main place that you're supposed to send resources to doesn't care about you and doesn't want to send you resources. And you're like, wait, why am I even working for these people? Fuck them. Like,
interesting.
I can do other things. And it's like, it's so clever because the game is saying, no matter that the original game is in itself like an exploration of power relations in a material way, you can always dig deeper and ask, what is the kind of power that isn't being discussed yet? You can always find other forms of exploitation to critique. It's really cool. And it's fun. It's a good scenario.
Yeah, very hard, I should go back to Frostpunk. The base game itself is very hard.
Yeah.
I should go back to it.
Sad entry into the obituary section. This week, Professor Charles Wade Mills died. He wrote a bunch of important books, but the most well-known is The Racial Contract. And I won't go in depth, but there are a lot of people eulogizing him, so I suggest to read it. He, like, you might think of a philosophy professor as kind of like a, you know, Poindexter, not revolutionary type, but he was a member of the Jamaican Communist Party, and, like, you know, he was followed by the CIA, and, like, you know, they worried that he was radicalizing people, and he was a member of, like, black resistance groups in Canada. He's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So he was, sadly, kind of cool. I really recommend reading The Racial Contract. It's pretty short. Like, I know the audiobook is, like, 4 hours long, which is pretty short. And a lot of people say, myself included, that that book is a real life changer because it really exposes the way that racism functions as a normal part of reality that is really easy to overlook.
Yep.
So sad to lose another comrade in arms.
Yep. Rest in power, as they say.
Yeah.
What are we doing next time?
We're going to talk about a book, Mordieu.
Ah, Mordieu. Yeah, we're going to do Mordieu, which is, sorry, I totally forgot. It was like an hour ago, and I'm tired and occupied. It's a book by Alex Febby. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Spoiler alert, he was like an interviewee on the other podcast that I do, Death Sentence, but before I was on that podcast, so I didn't get a chance to talk about this book. And it's very, very interesting. It's ostensibly a fantasy book, a coming-of-age story. There's magic and a boy. Not that one. Not Harry Potter. It doesn't have
magic
glasses.
And
the boy. But it's leftist and it's anti-capitalist and it's super fucking cool and it's the first of a trilogy, which I hope we get a second of soon, and we'll talk about that next time.
Cool. So bye for now. Thank you for listening.
Bye bye.
Oh, if you want more cool science fiction, go to anarchysf.com where there's like a cool list of stuff from all over the place.
Yeah, and maybe if you do, then we'll get more traffic and I'll have a reason to launch the 2.0 version of the site. Okay.
Cool. Bye.
Bye.